Setlist in association with 7 Digital.
This week, Tidal, RIAA and Dr. Dre. Welcome to Setlist, the music business podcast from CMU. I'm Andy Malt. With me is Chris Cook. Hello, Chris.
Hello there.
How are you doing?
I'm good.
Good.
You know how last week at the start of Setlist,
yeah,
we talked about how we needed to pick stories that could be communicated with single words to make that bit where you say this week over the music really punchy.
RIAA is surprisingly long, isn't it?
It's technically one word, I guess, but there's no good way of saying it.
They should really change their name.
It's a rubbish name for an organisation.
Well, it's not their name, is it? It's their acronym. They should have chosen a better name in order to get a better acronym.
I mean, I don't want to be seen to be overly patriotic, but BPI is a much better name. And somehow, even though that's three letters and RIAA, it's because you have to insert a glottal stop between the A's. That's the
problem.
Too
many vowels.
Whereas if it was RIA, well, that's still too many vowels, isn't it? So just knocking off America wouldn't work. What could they be called? They could be called...
USR.
US, what's that standing for?
US Records.
US Records. US Recordings.
USRI.
If they were
that sounds like some sort of disease.
They could be, obviously, BPI stands for the British Phonographic Industry.
Yeah.
Not the British Pornographic Industry. Sometimes people get phonograph and pornograph confused.
The API?
The API, although that does mean something else, doesn't
it?
That does have
That'd
a definite...
confusing.
I'm not sure the API is going to work. We'll have to stick with RIAA. It's so hard to say.
I mean, on the indie side, there's also ATIM. That's also not good. This is yet another argument for shutting down the entire music industry.
Just the American music industry.
No, all of it.
The British industry's fine. What I love about British trade bodies, I mean, actually the BPI is not doing it because it's British Phonographic Industry.
That's not a sentence anyone should ever say. But what I love about trade bodies...
But I like the fact that this isn't just a record industry. I like the fact how we have institutions in this country. Because we had an empire and we were the superpower in the period of history, 19th century, when sort of trade organisations and professional organisations and institutions sort of first started coming into being. We have all these things where we don't have the word British or UK in the title. And then everywhere else in the world has set up a similar organisation and has to insert their name. There's a sort of arrogance about that, which is probably behind the Brexit vote when we think about it. But the fact that we have the Music Publishers Association. Having said that, the Americans' version is the National Music Publishers Association. That's no help, is it? Basically, I think the entire music industry needs to sit down and have a really good think about what their trade bodies are called.
Or just shut them all down.
It is true. Once they got everyone in a room to do the big rebrand, maybe they could all merge.
Once they all got in the same room, they'd be able to look and say, oh, wow, there really are a lot of us, probably too many, and we're all doing each other's work. Let's all just shut down and start again.
I think merge and then merge all of their names.
That might be a long name.
So whenever we had to report on the trade body, it would be like, this week, the AIMBPIMPAMMF and all the rest. Afterwards, that would screw up. We need to do jingle then.
We would.
Maybe that's the...
Although we could just say trade body, because if there was only one...
People would know what we meant.
Yes.
Maybe the solution here isn't us rebranding every music into trade body in the world. Maybe the solution is you redoing the jingle. So we don't have quite such a tight little spot in which we need to get everything announced. Maybe that's actually the problem here.
I thought about that, but I don't think that's the answer.
That's not the answer. Okay, let's rebrand.
I think it is much more feasible that we just shut everyone down.
Well, maybe. Maybe. Hey!
Mm.
By the time you listen to this, not you.
I'm listening to it now.
You're listening
in
to it
real
right
time.
Now. By the time our listeners are listening to this edition of Setlist, we'll be in Great Escape Week. The Great Escape is upon us once again down in Brighton. So if you are coming down to the Great Escape, we will see you there. As you know, we're doing lots of stuff there, as always, as CMU and CMU Insights. We're starting on the Wednesday this year, remember? So if you can get down a day early, or maybe you're based in Brighton, we will be in Dukes at Comedia from 10 a.m. on Wednesday morning with our education conference. I had a meeting about that yesterday with the various people who have helped organise it. It's looking like it's going to be a really good day. And we're going to have some great conversations. I think there's going to be, you know how when you go to these conferences and sometimes everyone agrees with each other and everyone is like, oh, everything's great, basically. I think there's going to be a little bit of conflict in the room during our education conference.
Do you like conflict?
So make sure you come down if you can on the Wednesday. And at the end of the conference on the Wednesday, then the Great Escape has a brand new venue this year. It's on the beach. It's called The Beach. So that's nice and simple, isn't it?
It's confusing.
You think that's confusing?
The beach on the beach.
I think it's nice and simple. New venue called The Beach. Where's that? Well, it's on the beach. Simple. And that is officially opening just as the education conference finishes. So we'll be in the Dukes all day having our debates around music education. And then we'll all go en masse down to the beach for the big launch party.
Is it on the beach or in the beach?
What did I just say? In the beach?
Well, I don't know. Yeah. I just want to check where the party is. In the beach. In the beach, which is on the beach.
I see what you're doing there.
The party's not outside. It's not on the beach. It's going to be in the beach.
Now you're just being unnecessarily complicated.
I'm just confirming.
It is in the beach, which is on the beach.
Right.
Just to be absolutely clear. So see you at the beach, on the beach, for the beach party.
Yeah, don't say at the beach. You've got to say in the beach, or it's just going to get too confusing. You need to be very specific when you tell people where you're meeting them.
That's on the Wednesday night. Then Thursday, it's AI, as far as CMU is concerned, at Duke's all day. And then at the end of Thursday, also in Duke's at 4 o'clock, or actually 4:15 if you want to be precise, I'm going to be talking to Willard, the CEO and founder of Cobalt, who I've only ever interviewed on the phone before. I've never actually interviewed him on stage. Interviewed him a few times to inform articles. Finally going to get on stage with Willard to talk about the Cobalt business, and particularly...
You said that like that's the only two ways you could interview someone.
What, on the phone or on stage?
Yeah.
That's pretty much it, isn't it? What else is there?
Sometimes I go to a cafe and don't have an audience.
No, you don't want to do that. What's the point? If there's no one watching, what's the point? It doesn't happen. It only happens if someone is there to watch. And obviously, Cobalt have ramped up the AWOL side of their business, so trying to change the way the recording...
AWOL, not AWOL.
Well, you call it AWOL, don't you?
Yeah, I know, but I don't want people to get confused.
Did you
this
drink...
is the whole beach thing again.
Did you drink some pedant juice before we started this edition of
How
Set
Did You
List?
Know?
Is that what it's going to be like for the entire podcast?
Yep, this is going to be a very long record.
Well, I'm looking forward to it.
But anyway, there's not a bit of their business that's gone AWOL. They have a company called AWAL. We just got to make that clear. People might be confused.
Spelt AWAL, called AWOL. And, well, if you are confused, come to Dukes at Comedia next Thursday on the, what's that, the 17th of May at 4:15, and everything will be explained. Even Andy's tedious, pedantic questions. Everything will be answered. We're actually here today on this edition to talk about Friday at the Great Escape, which is our China conference, which is going to be absolutely brilliant. That's presented in association with the BPI, and we're going to be providing basically a beginner's guide to the Chinese music industry. So we're going to talk about recorded music in China, copyright in China, streaming in China, social media. We're going to have a couple of artists, British artists talking about their time in China, Chinese artists talking about their time in Britain, and then we'll finish the day looking at the touring market in China. And whenever I talk to our panelists on this about what we're going to talk about on the day, well, the challenge is going to be, I mean, you might think a whole day on China. Every one of the panelists who are taking part, when I've had my phone calls with them to flesh out what we're going to talk about, there's like an hour of really interesting stuff. So actually, the challenge is going to be squeezing it down to whatever it is, the 4 or 5 hours we have. So that's the China conference on the Friday. And then I'll just very quickly plug the last two CMU things that are happening. On the Friday at AIM House, so AIM have having their own little venue at the Great Escape this year. I say little venues, loads of stuff going on there. It's in the Queen's Hotel, which any Great Escape regular will know exactly where that is. And we are launching an exciting new research project that we are doing with AIM on the Friday evening. Well, say evening, 4:30 in AIM House. And on the Saturday, we're actually having quite a light day on the Saturday. There's a lot of stuff going on at the Great Escape on Saturday. Obviously, there's the entire festival going on.
Yeah.
In terms of the convention, there's lots of DIY events happening this year. We're not actively involved in that as CMU DIY, but there's loads of other partners presenting interesting sessions for people at the start of their music career, whether that's as an artist or behind the scenes. So do check out that programme. But we will be there at the end of the day on Saturday as CMU, because we always end the Great Escape convention. And that is a tradition now. We've been doing it, what, 8 bloody years? So that's definitely a tradition. I'd say that's a tradition.
Yeah, sounds like one.
Even with your pedant hat on, would you allow me to say that having done this for 8 years...
I don't know the technical length of a tradition. It could still just be a thing that happens. It could still be coincidence.
After 7 years, I think it is definitely a tradition. It's the Heroes and Villains panel, which is 4 industry veterans discussing the highs.
It's F-O-U-R.
Now I see what you're going to do.
Don't have to be an industry veteran to go.
As soon as I'd said that, I saw where you were going to take that.
Yep.
It is.
Just making sure no one's confused.
Not one, not two, not three, but 4 industry veterans talking about the highs and lows of their careers to date and the heroes and villains they met along the way. And this year's edition is extra special. Are you excited about it being an extra special edition of Heroes and Villains at the Great Escape this year?
Yeah.
Would you like to know why it's a special edition?
I know why. Oh, sorry, we're building, yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah.
CMU is 20 years old on the 18th of May. That is in the middle of the Great Escape this year. So it is our 20th birthday, so feel free to send cake. But where are you going to send the cake? Don't send it to our London office while we're at the Great Escape, because then we'll just get back on the Monday and there'll be a load of stale cake. So maybe don't send us cake.
I hate it when there's loads of stale cake in the postbox.
Don't send us cake.
Not again.
Do something more innovative than that. Join us, that's what you should do, at the Heroes and Villains special edition on Saturday at 4:30 in the old courtroom at the Great Escape. And on the panel there will be me. Are you excited about me?
I hear you speak quite frequently.
But I've never spoken on the Heroes and Villains panel. I moderated it once.
You did?
Badly.
So, well, yeah, it was.
But don't worry, I don't moderate Heroes and Villains usually. There was just that one year where, due to various circumstances...
It was quite last minute. You weren't prepared.
It was very last minute.
But let's all just forget about that one.
It is the only panel at The Great Escape where Stephen Jones, who moderates it every year, is so perfect to moderate this panel that if he couldn't do it, as he couldn't one year, it's like, oh, damn. It's the one panel where I have a perfect moderator and no one else can do it. But I will be on the panel being questioned by Stephen. And then the other people joining us on the panel, we have one of our earliest reviewers, one of our earliest advertisers, and one of our earliest PR contacts in the record industry, all of whom knew CMU back in 1998, 1999, when we first launched. So we have Edward Adu, the broadcaster and DJ, who was a reviewer with CMU back in the early days when we had reviewers, before Andy fired them all.
I did.
A few years ago when he declared the music review dead.
Yep.
Maybe we'll talk
and
about
I
that.
And I think that has proven to be true.
In addition to that...
Don't see him anymore, do you?
We've got Pat Carr from Remote Control, who also has worked at BMG, and Infectious, who was one of our first advertisers. She actually put some money into the bank account in the early days of CMU.
We're still living off that.
And here we are, still living off that. And then Sumit Bofra, who is now a manager and has been for a long time allied with ATC. But back in the late 1990s, he was running the college marketing department at Sony Music. And of course, in the early days, CMU had close affinities to the Student Music Network. And so he was one of our big champions in the early days. So that's going to be a nice, fun way to end The Great Escape. So if you are coming, then see you there. If you're not coming, I apologise that we've just talked about it at such length, but A, look out for our coverage of all those debates in the CMU Daily in the weeks that follow, and B, Andy's going to be there with his set list hat on, interviewing our panellists.
Yeah, you can see live set lists.
So in Dukes 2, next door to Dukes 1, as people come off stage having taken part in panels in our first room, they will be taking them next door into Dukes 2, where Andy and some other CMU people will be interviewing those people live. So you can come and watch interviews live, you can ask your own questions, but we're going to record everything that happens in Dukes 2. And then sometime later in the year, we're going to have a series of special setlist podcasts, which will come out probably on a separate feed, where you'll be able to hear all of those interviews at your leisure. So if you're not able to come, and let's think, what would be an acceptable excuse? Maybe you live in Australia and you've got to let builders in to build an extension. That would that be an acceptable excuse?
No.
Okay. If you can think of an acceptable excuse as to why you're not coming to The Great Escape, you can still benefit from all the debates and discussions with our reporting in CMU Daily and then the setlist interviews that will come out later in the year. Hey, I've pretty much filled this entire podcast talking about The Great Escape.
I know, we don't actually have very much longer left.
We better get on with our stories.
Yes, coming up this week, we've got the RIAA, that organisation's latest moves against US ISP Grand Communications, and the legal ruling that no one thinks of Dr. Dre when they think of sexual health. But first, Tidal has denied fiddling the listening figures for its exclusive albums from Kanye West and Beyoncé. It called claims that it had, made by a Norwegian newspaper, ridiculous and a smear campaign.
Yes, so this all relates to an article that came out in this Norwegian business newspaper last week. Can we just agree to refer to the newspaper as DN?
DN, yeah.
In the way that we would call the Financial Times, the FT.
Yes.
We'll call Dagens Nyheter.
Just DN. DN's fine. So let's not embarrass ourselves.
DN is a Norwegian business paper that has been following the Tidal business very closely.
It has.
And has been reporting on things to do with Tidal at regular intervals over the last couple of years, because let us not forget that Tidal was originally a Norwegian startup called WIMP.
Yes.
The worst name for a music service.
The worst name since RIAA.
Although, to be fair to them, as soon as they launched in an English-speaking market, they realised that. Hence the rebrand as Tidal, and then Jay-Z swooped in and bought them. But because they began in Norway and some of the corporate hierarchy still is based in that country, this paper DN has been following the developments of Tidal with quite some interest. And this investigation specifically relates to the stats that Tidal put out for how many times two specific albums were streamed on the platform. And it was two albums that Tidal had exclusively. Because, yes, of course, there was a period when that was what Tidal was all about. They haven't actually done that in a while, have they?
No.
But there was 18 months where Tidal was all about, we have exclusive first dibs on an album, in some cases for a few weeks, and in other cases, actually.
Well, in the case of one of these albums, yeah, permanently.
They still have the exclusive. So we're talking about Kanye West's album, Life of Pablo, and Beyoncé's album, Lemonade. Both Kanye and Beyoncé obviously being involved in the Tidal business. And so those were both exclusives to Tidal. And when they first went online, a bunch of stats were put out by Tidal as to just how much those records had been listened to by Tidal subscribers. At the time, people were like, whoa, that's a lot of listens, given that by your own admission, you only have 3 million subscribers. Yeah. And some people think that that's slightly exaggerating how many users you've got. And so based on people chattering about those figures don't seem right, it seems that ever since this DN newspaper have been digging to try and see whether or not those figures were accurate or whether, in fact, something was happening behind the scenes to make the number of plays seem a lot higher than it really was.
So the paper says it somehow acquired a hard disk full of internal Tidal data, which correlated with the figures that it had reported to the record industry. It then approached some of the individual Tidal subscribers who were listed as heavy listeners of one or both of those albums in that data and said to them, did you listen to this that many times? And it seems quite a few of them went, no, I'd never listened to it 6 billion times.
Yeah, in some cases it was basically in order to have listened to it the number of times the system was saying, or at least this is what the paper is alleging, that they would have to be pretty much listening to the album on repeat, like 12 hours a day for a week. So at least some of the people that they spoke to were like, yeah, that's not right. There's no way I listened to that record that many times.
So the paper went and did that research itself, and it also handed the same data over to academics at the Norwegian University of Science and Technology, who employed, the newspaper says, advanced statistical analysis to determine that the data had been manipulated to inflate the listening figures for those Beyoncé and Kanye albums.
Now, quite how they worked that out, well, if you read Norwegian, the article goes into quite some detail. There's also a report from the academics. So if you're really interested, you can go and translate all of that. Or maybe you speak Norwegian, in which case...
Some people do.
Knock yourself out. Go and read about how it is that they're of the opinion that something had happened to these figures, that the number of plays for these specific albums had been heightened in some way. And I mean, quite significantly heightened, yeah, is the allegation. It's not that they added a few extra plays in.
I mean, they're talking about hundreds of millions of plays.
That didn't actually take place, is the allegation. I keep saying is the allegation, because Tidal are adamant that this is not true. And DN did say in their report that lawyers working for Tidal had already been in touch, having heard this investigation was underway, and was seemingly trying to put pressure onto both the paper and the academics not to go through with this research, but they published last week. And Tidal says that the accusations are not true. They also then lay into the newspaper itself and basically are saying DN has been trying to find fault with our business ever since the start. They point out that some of the language that the paper has used, so for example, they dissed both Jay-Z and one of the executives there using not very nice language. And so they're basically saying, this paper is just out to find a story where it isn't there. And so, of course, they found this story and it's not true. And they seem to be suggesting that it's not Tidal who have manipulated the data. It's that the newspaper has manipulated the data in order to create a story, seems to be the counter-allegation. I sort of feel there could be some litigation coming out of all of this. So that's why I'm being so clear, particularly as you were insistent at the start of this podcast that there was no room for confusion. We especially don't want confusion where it might result in litigation. My plan at Heroes and Villains, when it comes to me picking my villains, by the way, is to just list everyone who's tried to sue us over the years.
It's a long list.
But we don't want to add Jay-Z and Tidal to that list. So we're very clear on this is what DN are...
I could bring the letters to pass around.
...are alleging, and this is what Tidal are counter-alleging. But I suppose it is worth stressing that if it is true, and Tidal were somehow heightening the stats for how many times these two albums were listened to, that isn't just a case of them then having over-the-top stats that they can brag about. Oh my God, how many times this album's been listened to, this album's listened to. It's more than just what we call the stats brag.
Well, yes, I suppose that is the question. You know, why does this matter? If they're saying they're more popular than they are, people say they're more popular than they are all the time. I mean, I'm very popular.
And we definitely know that's not true. So it isn't just bragging to be more popular than you are. Because, of course, how many times you get played on a streaming service has an effect on how much you get paid. And not only does it mean that if you say that a record got played 10 times more than it did, that that person then gets 10 times more money than they are due. It's more complicated than that. Hey, Dissecting Digital Dollars is about to be plugged, I feel. It's more complicated.
I'll put a link in the show notes.
Because of the way that the streaming business works, all the money at the end of the month goes into a pot, and then it is divvied up between all of the rights owners based on their share of overall consumption. And then you say, okay, 10% is due to Universal Music, and then we split that with Universal Music based on our revenue share agreement. So the crucial point is, assuming that Tidal were paying out on that model, now there might be some advances or minimum guarantees thrown in there to confuse things even further. If it was being paid out on that model, in the months where these allegedly heightened stats originate, it would mean that not only were Beyoncé and Kanye and their labels getting quite a lot more money than they were due, other artists will be seeing less money than they are due because of the way it all gets divvied up and split.
So then you're getting dangerously close to accusations of financial fraud.
Basically, yes. So this is quite a big allegation on DN's part, hence the immediate rejection of those allegations by Tidal as soon as that publication came out. And I suspect, not that I know much about libel laws in Norway, but I would say it's a sufficiently serious allegation that almost Tidal would have to take some legal action in order to fight that allegation. So it will be very interesting to see how this turns out. But as it currently stands, certainly, well, DN did say that they'd already had correspondence from Tidal's lawyers and they ploughed ahead with their investigation. So they do seem very keen to stick by this story. And I suppose trying to use the fact that they involved academics in a university to give their allegations some credibility. I think there was then allegations on the other side that maybe the journalists had misled the academics or something like that. So lots of arguments and counter-arguments. So, well, keeps us talking about Tidal.
Yeah, and that's increasingly uncommon.
It is. streaming has become very much an Spotify, Apple, Amazon conversation.
You kind of forget that Tidal exists, don't
so
you?
So it's nice.
Except, you know, when things like this happen.
to be able to talk about the other services, the Tidals and the Deezers and the Napsters. I had lunch with an old friend the other day who's still an eMusic subscriber.
I'd completely forgotten that ever existed.
eMusic still exists, apparently. No allegations of dodgy figures in that domain, though. That's good old-fashioned downloads. None of this newfangled, complicated streaming. But yeah, interesting story. Definitely want to watch.
Still to come, some news in brief, plus Dr. Dre the gynecologist. But now, the Recording Industry Association of America,
also known as
the RIAA, wants the US courts to consider its newly beefed up complaints about internet service provider Grand Communications.
So this is a long running legal dispute between the American record industry and this American ISP called Grand. And it is very much mirroring the earlier litigation, which was between BMG and another American ISP called Cox Communications. And I can't remember. I feel like we talked about BMG versus Cox quite a bit on Setlist.
We did, yes.
But we haven't necessarily talked so much about RIAA versus Grand because, as we've already discussed...
It seems like the lesser sequel.
We try not to talk about RIAA too much because it's a nightmare to say. But in essence, that was the record industry's trade body pursuing litigation based on the precedents set first time round in BMG versus Cox. And it's all about whether or not internet service providers should be held liable for their users' copyright infringement and to what extent ISPs can plead that favourite of the record industry, safe harbour protection.
Yeah, so Grand tried to have this entire case dismissed, although it failed, but although the courts did allow it to proceed, they did cut down the RIAA's lawsuit somewhat by removing Grand's parent company as a defendant and also ruling that the record industry could only sue for contributory infringement, not vicarious infringement, which is important because it then has an impact on what damages can be claimed.
Yeah, so when Grand asked the courts to basically throw this entire case out, no questions asked, The judges said, no, we do think that there is a sufficient case to go, you know, to full court hearing on the allegation that maybe because Grand Communications not only allowed people to infringe copyright on their networks, but that they didn't properly deal with what they call repeat infringers. The people who keep infringing, being told don't infringe and they keep repeating. There's enough of an argument at least to go to court to say because Grand didn't deal with their repeat infringers, maybe they are liable for contributory infringement, maybe they lose safe harbour protection, as was basically the judgment in the BMG versus Cox case. There was the added complication that the BMG versus Cox case was then thrown out on appeal, but on a technicality. So the basic judgment sort of still stands. But yes, as you say, the case that is now proceeding has been stripped back somewhat, and particularly with this distinction between contributory infringement and vicarious infringement. And that is all really to do with whether or not you can argue that not only did Grand not do what it should do to stop repeat infringers, it was actually profiting from its inaction. So it was deliberately ignoring repeat infringers because it could make more money, because it didn't have to shout at its customers or ultimately disconnect those customers. So it was a financially driven decision rather than just not fulfilling your obligations under copyright law. And the court, when considering Grand's application for dismissal, considered the case. They reckon that there wasn't enough evidence to suggest that there was vicarious infringement, but the RIAA have now gone back to court and said, well, okay, with the paperwork that we originally submitted, we understand that you don't think we had a strong case of vicarious infringement, but as part of the discovery process of this legal battle, so that's where you get people sharing documents backwards and forwards, two sides on a legal dispute, we've discovered some new evidence. And we think if only you would look at this new evidence, you will see that there is definitely a case for vicarious infringement. Oh, and also this evidence, they are saying, also proves why the parent company should be a co-defendant. So basically, it's the RIAA saying, all that stuff that you cut off our original case, here's some new evidence. Will you please reinstate it all?
Yeah, so among that evidence is the fact that Grand was seemingly taking action against repeat infringers up until 2010 and has started doing so again more recently. So the RIAA is now saying Grand's failure to act against repeat infringers between 2011 and 2016 was a deliberate decision and therefore, as you say, is vicarious infringement, not contributory.
Or both. But or crucially, both. That they made that decision deliberately because they thought they could make more money by doing so. Is the allegation that the RIAA, did I say enough A's then? Even if they won't rebrand, we should come up with a different way of referring
they
to
They must have to deal with this on a daily basis.
As you say, some people do say RIAA, don't they?
I don't like that.
That's no better.
No.
The RIAA want the judge to, in essence, reinstate the full lawsuit as it originally stands based on this other evidence. So that just further prolongs this entire dispute because it now means that if the court accepts that new evidence, accepts new arguments, then Grand will have to then respond to that in court and construct a new argument as to why the evidence should or shouldn't be accepted. All of which is delaying us actually getting to the nitty-gritty of this case, which is, did Grand lose their safe harbour protection by not dealing with repeat infringers in the way that the court reckoned that Cox had in the BMG case. So when that question will finally get before a judge, I don't know, because I'm sure this will result in a load more delays.
Well, it's going to result in some delay, but it may set the whole thing pretty much back to square one. So yeah, we'll see. We might have to wait for any sort of conclusion on this. Just quickly, time for some news in brief now. We've been talking about Sony Music selling off its Spotify shares. Turns out Warner has really been going hell for leather in that regard. It's sold off 75% of the shares it holds in Spotify.
Yeah, another major record company offloading their Spotify shares pretty much as soon as they could when Spotify listed on the stock exchange in New York last month. This was admitted in a financial reporting session by Warner Music. They were keen to stress that they didn't want people to think that them offloading three quarters of their stock so quickly suggested that they were pessimistic about the future of Spotify.
Well, given how much their finances are tied up in Spotify's future, making it look bad is not a good move.
So they were stressing that, you know, Warner Music isn't an investment company. They're not in the business of holding equity in publicly listed companies. So they decided that they should cash in quick, but they remain confident about the future of Spotify. We still have our share in Spotify. I forgot to check the share price as we started
recording. I haven't, but it was down quite considerably. I mean, considerably. We lost almost $10 the other day.
Yeah.
Well, that's pretty... pretty depressed.
We talked last week about how it slipped. It continued to slip, so that when we recorded last week's podcast, we were basically, if we'd sold it, we would have sold it for what we bought it. But yeah, last time I looked, we were $10 down. So
we could be up again now.
Negative coffee, I think, is going to be the outcome of that.
You're going to have to go to Pret and give them some coffee.
Yes.
A law firm has filed a class action over allegations that Live Nation breached its Ticketmaster consent decree.
That being the agreement that Live Nation reached with the American Department of Justice when Live Nation and Ticketmaster merged back in 2010. This all follows a story in the New York Times last month, I think, in which it was alleged that Department of Justice officials were investigating whether Live Nation was not following that consent decree, basically in using Live Nation's dominance in the touring market in order to score extra business for Ticketmaster. Certainly Live Nation and Ticketmaster have denied those allegations. This is a law firm filing a class action on behalf of investors in the company, saying that if they have been breaching this consent decree, then people who bought shares in Live Nation over the last 12 months should have a right to sue for damages. It did seem to be one of those class actions where they were still really looking for a plaintiff to lead on the case. So they filed the paperwork, and anyone who was invested in Live Nation during a certain time period is being encouraged to come forward by this law firm to see whether or not that is something to actually actively pursue.
Going back to the reduction of single-use plastic on independent festival sites, which we discussed recently, Bestival has now said that it will ban single-use plastic bottles from its bars this year. Instead, it's going to have water in aluminium cans.
Yeah, my recommendation that they just have taps that people lean over the bar and have the liquids.
Well, you recommend that for all drinks.
I did recommend that for all drinks. So yeah, instead of bottled water, canned water. And you might think, well, hang on a second, is that any better? But apparently it is, because aluminium cans are much easier to recycle. They are much more prolifically recycled. So if we have
They're
to choose...
They're much more energy efficient when you recycle them.
If we have to choose between some plastic in which your water is carried or some aluminium cans, then the latter is much more environmentally friendly. So we are told.
The show notes for this episode will have links to all those stories and everything we discussed this week on Setlist. If you go to setlistpodcast.com, you'll find them there. And finally this week, Dr. Dre, D-R-E, has lost a trademark battle with celebrity gynecologist Dr. Dre. That's D-R-A-I. I don't want any confusion.
It's a good job we're having a pedantic issue with the set list, isn't it? To be absolutely clear on that.
So obstetrician, gynecologist and media personality Dreon M. Birch applied to trademark his nickname Dr. Dre,
D-R-A-I,
D-R-A-I in the US in 2015. For healthcare provision and motivational speaking. The hip-hop producer and music mogul Dr. Dre, D-R-E, opposed the application, but has been unsuccessful in doing so, mainly because he's not a gynecologist. I mean, he's not even a real doctor.
Yeah, so Dre,
D-R-E,
D-R-E, quickly objected to Dre,
D-R-A-I,
applying for this trademark and lodged an objection, as you are allowed to do when people apply for trademarks.
Because, yeah, for some reason, Dr. Dre, D-R-E, thought there might be confusion between him and Dr. Dre, D-R-A-I.
Well, I think
I think that we've proven that not to be the case.
No need for confusion at all. Now, bit of trademark law here. Generally speaking, trademark law allows people to register very similar marks where they operate in different industries. So the example that I always give is that in the 1990s, here in the UK, we had Oasis the band, Oasis the drink, and Oasis the shop, all of whom owned the trademark Oasis. One of it owned it in entertainment, one in retail, one in food and drink. So that's how trademark works. When you register a trademark, you have to say, I am operating in these sectors. I want the exclusive rights to that name in those sectors, but I'm not stopping people from operating elsewhere. Also, of course, we have the Beatles company, Apple Corp, and we have the computer company, Apple. They both have the Apple trademark in different sectors. There was a little bit of a disagreement in the early days of iTunes, but it looked like they were both in music. But they can happily coexist. And so that is the important principle of trademark law that you need to know, because that is why Dr. Dre has not managed to stop Dr. Dre from calling himself Dr. Dre and having a Dr. Dre trademark. I've given up. Being precise, people will have to work it out from context.
Yeah, so basically because they operate in different fields, one in music, one in gynecology, there is no crossover. So says the judging panel that ruled on Dr. Dre, DRE's opposition. But the other reason you might object to a trademark application is because you're worried that people might think that you are moving in to a different field of work. People might think that Dr. Dre, D-R-E, is becoming a gynecologist and doing motivational speaking about gynecology.
Yeah, because he started off making music and then he became a bit of a label mogul and then he moved into tech.
He is known for jumping around a bit.
Now he is a headphones brand and an Apple executive. So why not gynecology next? It sort of seems like the logical move.
I mean, it's a bit like that thing we discussed on a previous episode of Setlist, where the Wu-Tang Clan were opposing a trademark application by a dog walking business called the Wu-Tang Clan, because no one would, as we discussed before, want to think that Method Man was going to be out walking dogs.
So that was another argument put forward, but as we have already said, it didn't work because Dr. Dre won this particular dispute and Dr. Dre was left without getting his wishes granted.
Yeah, the judges overseeing this case said, although the opposer has established that his name, Dr. Dre, D-R-E, is of sufficient fame or reputation, he has failed to show that a connection would be presumed in the mind of the consuming public when applicant's Dr. Dre, D-R-A-I, marks are used in connection with its applied for goods and services. The music industry and the gynecology industry are not similar enough. Although they are all full of... Anyway, so basically, no one thinks of sexual health when they think of Dr. Dre. That is the big news.
I think it should
Although
be...
now I do, every time.
Every time you see someone wearing Beats by Dre headphones, that's what you start
thinking
about.
I think, that's going to need some ointment.
I think we should be congratulated for avoiding the obvious gag in this story in both our CMU Daily Report and our Setlist summary.
Yeah, although I just stopped myself.
So anyway, well done, Dr. Dre, and commiserations, Dr. Dre.
Yes, I'm glad there's no confusion between the two.
Everything on this edition of Setlist has been 100% clear.
Yes, that's all the clarity we have time for. So we've come to the end of this week's show. You can find us on all the social media if you want to follow us, get updates on when the new episodes come out, and we post links on interesting music business stories. It's all very much worth following. If you search for Setlist Pod on whichever social media you prefer, or all of them, even LinkedIn, that's where you'll find us probably. You could email us, like in the olden days, setlist@unlimitedmedia.co.uk. Setlist is the music business podcast from CMU. It's presented by me, Andy Malt, and Chris Cook, produced by Matt Peaty, edited by Jason Wolfe. And for more on CMU, go to completemusicupdate.com.
Recorded at Unique Facilities, Setlist is an Unlimited production.